Dakshaha.
Daksha.
Grihita. Accepted. Arhana. Rightful. Sadhana uttamam. Sacrificial vessel. Yajna Ishvaram. Unto the master of all sacrifices. Vishwasrijam. Of all the Prajapatis. Param. The supreme. Gurum. Preceptor. Sunanda Nanda Adi Anugahai. By associates like Sunanda and Nanda. Vritam. Surrounded. Muda. With great pleasure. Grinan. Offering respectful prayers. Prapede. Took shelter. Prayataha. Having a subdued mind. Krita Anjalehi. With folded hands. Translation. When Lord Vishnu accepted the oblations offered in the sacrifice, Daksha the Prajapati began with great pleasure to offer respectful prayers unto him. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is actually the master of all sacrifices and preceptor of all the Prajapatis. And he is served even by such personalities as Nanda and Sunanda. You repeat, when Lord Vishnu accepted the oblations, offered in the sacrifice, Daksha the Prajapati began with great pleasure to offer respectful prayers unto him. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is actually the master of all sacrifices and preceptor of all the Prajapatis. And he is served even by such personalities as Nanda and Sunanda. So there's no purport to this text, nor the next text, so we'll read the next two texts. So Daksha Uvacha. Shudam Swadam Yuparata Kila Bhujavastam. Chinmatramekam Havayam Pratisidyamayam. Tishtam Stayoiva Purushat. Purushatvam upechatasyam aste bhavana parishura ivatmatantraha. Translation. Daksha addressed the Supreme Personality of Godhead. My dear Lord, you are transcendental to all speculative positions. You are completely spiritual, devoid of all fear, and you are always in control of the material energy. Even though you appear in the material energy, you are situated transcendentally. You are always free from material contamination because you are completely self-sufficient. Text 27. Vitvija uchuhu tatvam natevayam anjana rudrasapat. Karmanyavagraha Dio Bhagavan Vidama Dharmopalakshanam Idam Tivid Adva Avarakyam Yatam Yarartam Adidoivam Ado Vivastataha. The priest addressed the Lord, saying, O Lord, transcendental to material contamination, by the curse offered by Lord Shiva's men, we have become attached to fruitive activities, and thus we are now fallen, and therefore do not know anything about you. On the contrary, we are now involved in the injunctions of the three departments of Vedic knowledge under the plea of executing rituals in the name of Yajna. We know that you have made arrangements for distributing the respective shares of the demigods. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The Vedas are known as Trigunya Vishaya Vedaha. It's from the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, text 45. Now, those who are serious students of the Vedas are very much attached to the ritualistic ceremonies mentioned in the Vedas. And therefore, these Vedavadis cannot understand that the ultimate goal of the Vedas is to understand Lord Krishna or Vishnu. Those who have transcended the qualitative Vedic attractions, however, can understand Krishna, who is never contaminated by the material qualities. Therefore, Lord Vishnu is addressed here as Ananjana, free from material contamination. In Bhagavad Gita, the second chapter, text 42, the crude Vedic scholars have been deprecated by Krishna as follows. Yam imam pushpitam vacham pravadan chavai paschitaha vedavararata parata nanyarastiti vadinaha. Men of small knowledge are very much attached to the flowery words of the Vedas, and they say that there is nothing more than this. Okay? So, Omagana Timidandasha Granjana Shilakaya Chakshurun Miditam Yena Tasmai Shigadavena Maha. So, one question for you all: what does the word Veda mean? What? Wow. Just see, Chintamani. Prakarasuna Sadmashu. Kalpa Vriksha. So it means knowledge. And what does the word Vedanta mean? That means finished with knowledge, just ignorance? What? Conclusion. The conclusion or the result like that. All right. So Veda, Vedanta. So in a larger sense, in a very larger sense, I mean, all books that deal with knowledge can be called Veda. You understand? And of course, there's phenomenal and numinous knowledge, as described by Krishna in the Gita. Phenomenal means basically what you can see, the phenomena. And numinous means what you can't see, and beyond the realm of experiencing jurisdiction, as Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would say. So when we talk about Vedas, it's quite interesting that in a larger sense, any book of knowledge can be considered Vedic literature. It's really interesting. And then, of course, people have this conception also of Vedic culture, which is a really interesting description. What is Vedic culture? And when did it take place? And that's also another question. Or what is Vedic architecture? What is Vedic dress? What is Vedic marriage? What is Vedic food? You know, I'm not going to get into the whole thing. You know, but what does it mean? I mean, because, of course, as I mentioned before, Veda means knowledge. So let's take Veda indicating spiritual knowledge. So, you know, Vedic culture would be that culture which actually helps one advance spiritually, right? And if one takes it in that way. But if one takes it in a larger sense of knowledge about this material world and how to achieve trivarga means dharma, artha, and kama. What is trivarga? Dharma means being a materially religious person. Artha means investing in the stock market and getting a lot of money. And kama means just good old enjoyment. Just like I was watching this one film, and there was an interview with some stupid lady, excuse the expression. Not that ladies are stupid, but she was a stupid lady. And she was talking about the Kama Sutra. And did you see this? No, you didn't see it. She said, India's a land. It was actually a BBC report on India. You know, some stupid BBC report. Sometimes it's good BBC reports. But she said, India's a land where people don't have any inhibitions or guilt feelings about anything. And I was just thinking, huh? What India have you been in, lady? I mean, there's actually more guilt feelings in India than there are in a Jewish home. isn't it? There's a lot of guilt. I mean, it's right, people commit suicide and everything. Huh? He said, yes, and India is a culture where we learn to enjoy the body, and we have this nice Kama Sutra. And when she, and I said, huh? And actually, the Kama Sutra, incidentally, for those of you who don't know, the Kama Sutra is a more recent text. It is not one of the original Vedic literatures written by Vyasadeva. It is written several hundred years ago by, you know, people who happen to be lusty. You know, it's crazy. I mean, just like when I was in university, I was studying, trying to study the Vedic literature, and then, you know, went to the bookstore, and one of the main books there was the Kama Sutra, which I didn't read, thank God. And there were Mayavadi interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita and other books too, you know, Upanishads and everything like that. So, anyway, so that's not knowledge, that's ignorance. Avidya. There's vidya and avidya, ignorance. So, anyway, so in a material sense, the Vedic literatures propose the Trivarga, Dharma, Artha, and Kama, which is not a very good idea. And then even the Vedic literatures talk about moksha, which is also not a good idea. So let's look at the history of the Indian Vedic literatures. Anyway, we were talking about Vedic culture. Vedic culture means that which helps one advance spiritually. What's that? Oh, it's louder, okay. Vedic culture is one that helps one advance spiritually, and it's not, doesn't indicate a specific type of clothes or a specific type of architecture, which is interesting, other than something's in tune with Vastu. Now, Vastu is actually the information about Vastu in Ayurveda and the astrological treatises are contained in the Atharva Veda. You understand? So that's, you know, that's actually the original Vedic stuff. But it doesn't indicate a specific type of architecture. Just like you see. Anyway, there could be many types of architecture that fit into Vastu, into the science of Vastu. Just like we've been describing before, there's this whole discussion in the on the internet, about whether the design, the proposed design for the temple in Mayapur is Vedic or not. And people are very upset because it happens to look like the Capitol building in the United States. Especially in India, they're upset about that. And actually, it also looks like many British buildings that have been erected in India. So people are extremely upset about it. They say, why is this? It should be Vedic. Yeah, but actually, it's interesting. Prabhupada, when he was in Washington, he said, you know, the temple should look like that. You know, he looked at the Capitol building with the dome. He said, yes, it's a good design. It should look like that. So Prabhupada was actually, you know, transcendental to not Vedic knowledge, but he was transcendental to people's mundane conception of what Vedic is. And who knows what, you know, original Vedic architecture is, because if you go to India, you won't find anything that's thousands of years old anyway, any temples that are thousands of years old. What you'll find is the oldest temples, of course, are the temples with 1,000 pillars in them, and it wouldn't be very useful to construct a temple according to that architectural standard because you wouldn't be able to see the deities. Because, in other words, they didn't have a lot of clear space in them. Clear space means, you know, space between the supporting members. Like here in this temple, we have a lot of clear space. Everyone understands that, clear space? In other words, there's no beams running through, you know, the middle of the room, which is really cool. That's why one of the reasons I picked the dome. So, but in the oldest temples in India, you don't have that. You have pillars like every, I would say every 2 yards or every two or three yards. And, you know, you start dancing around there, you can get in trouble. Especially at my age, you know, you start hitting the pillars. You get in trouble. Anyway, it's pretty good if you want to have Lord Nrisimhadeva coming out. There's plenty of places for him to come out of there. But other than that, you know, Anyway, so Vedic doesn't mean a specific style of architecture. It means basically the Vastu conception, you know, where things are actually oriented towards the east and the west and south and north in a certain way. You have fire in one direction, you have water in another direction, you have cooking going on somewhere else, or the bathroom going on somewhere else, and then you have Brahmastan in the middle. Anyway, that's Vedic. That's the Vedic thing. It doesn't say you got to have dome shape like this, little scallops in the arches. You know scallops? No, you don't know what scallops are. Scallops, and when you have an arch, a scallop is like, you know, like in my, you see the pictures, like a scallop means like little curlies, things like that. As the arch, you know, the arch is actually not just an arch, but there's scallops, it's these little curls in the arch. But the Vedas don't talk about that stuff like that. Okay, just so you know that. So anyway, it's a big controversy about what, you know, how the temple should look, and then people are just like fighting all over the internet, like they do about everything on the internet. I mean, just like, and the internet has some positive points to it, but a lot of negative points. I mean, it's like we're dealing with this, with an issue in Croatia. The devotee sent me a letter yesterday that unless you do something about this by September 11th, imagine they pick September 11th, it's going to be all over, you know. I said, huh? I said, why don't you pick a different date, you know? I'm sensitive about that date. So, you know, there's so much garbage there. I've just been planning my mind one day when I can just put an automatic response to all my emails, you know. I'm taking a break, you know. Send your email 6 months from now. So, anyway, so let's get back to the Vedic thing. So, as far as the Vedas in India, because in one sense, you know, the Vedas can come from other places too. You know, as long as it's knowledge, not speculative knowledge, but, you know, knowledge by the descending process. So, anyway, so as far as the Vedas in India, originally it's described there was one Veda, that was the Rig Veda. No, actually it wasn't the Rig Veda, it was the Yajurveda, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was the Yajurveda, because there were sacrifices. And then Vyasadeva saw the people really couldn't figure things out if they just read that one Veda. You know, because it was the Yuga Sanjam. It was the end of the Dwarpa Yuga. Each Yuga has three different segments to it, you know, beginning, middle, and end. So each Yuga is composed. And the Bhagavatam also describes there's actually within each Yuga, there's a Kali Yuga within each Yuga, there's a Dwarpa Yuga, a Satya Yuga, etc. Treta Yuga, I know they're not in order, within each and every Yuga. So right now, the beginning of the Yuga cycle, we have sort of like a Satya Yuga. Imagine, this is like the Satya Yuga within the Kali Yuga. We're in trouble later on. So Vyasadeva saw that, you know, people just couldn't figure out that one Veda. And he said, well, all right, let's divide it into four. And then you have the four Vedas, which we mentioned many times before, the Rig, the Sama, Atharva, and Yajurveda. And he actually thought, well, let me assign different personalities to take charge of the four Vedas. So he assigned different personalities, like Vaishya Payana, to take charge of all the Vedas. And then he said, let's make this Mahabharat for the people who are less intelligent, who couldn't understand the four Vedas. And so then he put, in charge of the Mahabharat, he put our friend Romaharshana, who was later killed by Balaram. I think you all know that story, right? So then he put Romaharshan in charge of the Mahabharat. And then after even doing all that, he was still depressed. He said, you know, he left something out. And he was sitting there just like thinking, what have I done wrong? I'm trying to be Vedic. But, you know, something's going wrong. And then because he was a good disciple of his spiritual master, Narada Muni, his spiritual master came, which is really interesting. the spiritual master comes right in the nick of time. Prabhupada also said in the fourth canto, part four, that if one dedicates himself to the mission of the spiritual master, then one is able to, even after the spiritual master leaves this planet, then the super soul appears to that particular individual. It's interesting. Fourth canto, part four, is quite interesting. Of course, we're talking about the Paranjana story, where Malayadvaja is lamenting over the king. Vidarbha is lamenting over King Malayadvaja. And here the king is figuratively taken to be the spiritual master, and she's figuratively taken to be the wife, of course, the wife of the king, and also the disciple of the spiritual master. And Prabhupada comments on it. Makes many interesting comments that one should be ready to leave the body with the spiritual master if one is not ready to carry out the order of the spiritual master. That's one comment. But then the most interesting comment is that, as we mentioned before, is that if one dedicates himself to the mission of the spiritual master, then the super soul appears before such a person, which is interesting, isn't it? And I was thinking about that. What does that actually mean? And why is Prabhupada saying that? And Prabhupada also said, another interesting statement is that one should want to dedicate himself to the mission of the spiritual master rather than looking for Krishna under different bushes or some, just paraphrasing, bush in Vrindavan. So that is actually Prabhupada's personal realization, that when Prabhupada is actually revealing his mind, actually revealing his heart, what he personally experienced upon taking the order of his spiritual master seriously and coming to the Western world. Whereas many of his god brothers did not take that order as seriously, or at least did not execute the order to preach in English. I mean, Prabhupada got that order. That was the final order that Prabhupada got from his spiritual master, isn't it? Letter, like 2 weeks before the Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur left this planet. He said, you should preach good. It'll be do good for you and do good for others, so you preach in English. And so that was the final order. And Prabhupada had written a letter saying, previous to that, saying, so many of your disciples are doing so much nice service for you. And Prabhupada was thinking, but what can I do? I'm just a householder. What am I? I'm entangled like that. That was Prabhupada's last letter to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, you preach in English. Then you will do good for yourself and do good for others. I mean, paraphrasing, that's not the exact wording. So Prabhupada took that order seriously. And then, so Prabhupada's realization is if you take the order seriously, that's what happens. You see the super soul. So getting back to the story of Vyasadeva was taking the order of his spiritual master seriously, meditating on how to accomplish the order to be compassionate to the souls in Kali Yuga. And then his spiritual master appears. Narada Muni appears. And the first thing Narada Muni says to him is not, how are you doing? basically not too many niceties there. It's that, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How's your health? Like when we talk, the first thing he does is chastises him. Are you satisfied with identifying the body with the self, with the soul? The guru comes, you haven't seen him for some time, and all of a sudden you're saying, you're Maya. Well, when you have a good relationship with the guru, he can do that. If you're actually surrendered, like we see with Prabhupada's disciples, that some of them were actually surrendered, some of us, not me. Prabhupada could chastise them like that. And the ones that weren't so surrendered, doing a good job, like that. But the ones who surrendered, are you satisfied with being in Maya? Or like Prabhupada said to Tamal Krishna Maharaj, when Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, I don't want to go to China, Prabhupada said, you have a choice. You either go to China or you just stay here in Mayapur and don't do anything else. Just chant. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, all right, I'll go to China. So So he was very heavy. with his spiritual master, with his disciple, I'm sorry. And then he said something very interesting. He said those words that don't describe the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that's like a place of pilgrimage for crows. Now, those of you who are not from India, you wouldn't relate to that example. But if you ever go to India and you see the garbage dumps, they're not like in America where they got a big bulldozer to just like push everything underground. But the crows are there. And not just one crow, but these giant crows. Like as big as Mahamantra. And the beak is this long. No, not quite that big, but they're big crows. And they're just picking the stool. One year we went to Jagannath Puri, and there was the sewerage line was right next to our hotel. And in India, the sewerage lines are not underground, and they're not lines. They're trenches. And they were crows like anything there. So that example was very interesting that Srila Narada Muni used. It's like a place of pilgrimage for crows, he said. And then he recited this famous verse, Tadvad visarga janataga viplo yasmin pratislokam abadavachyapi namananantashi yasho nikatani yat shrinvanti gayanti grinanti yat sadavaha. That those words, Tadvag Visargo, Nanataga Viplavo, that glorify the Lord, in this sinful material world, can create a revolution in the misdirected lives of an impious civilization. Prabhupada is one of Prabhupada's favorite verses. Yasmin Patis Lokam Vadavatyupi Namana Nantasha Yasho Nikataniyat Shrinvanti Gayanti. One should hear and chant it. So that was the instruction that he gave, that instead of concentrating or writing so much about, you know, Trivarga, the material goals, you should just glorify Krishna. And therefore, Srila Vyasadeva composed the Srimad Bhagavatam at that particular juncture. Now, sometimes people say the Srimad Bhagavatam is in the category of what we call the Puranas. Purana means old, actually. And there's another category called Itihasa. Itihasa means history. So an Itihasa literature would be like the Ramayana. A Purana means old. It also is like history, but it has different categories. And it has like the cosmic creation. The difference between the Ramayana and the Puranas, or the Ramayana and the Srimad Bhagavatam, is the Ramayana deals specifically just with the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra, the things that occurred before, and the personalities around the pastimes of Lord Ramchandra. Whereas the Srimad Bhagavatam deals with the cosmic creation, the subsequent creation, and all the other topics that are there in the Puranas. So one may say that these Puranas, sometimes the atheists or, you know, those people who want to decry the Vedic literature say the Puranas are actually something new. And actually, you know, worship of Vishnu was not something, you know, that was there Vedically. But there's a lot of evidence to the contrary. First of all, the Puranas are mentioned in the Chandogya Upanishad. Chandogya Upanishad is actually one of the oldest of the Upanishads. I think it's even contained in the original four Vedas. And the Chandogya Upanishad mentions Itihasya Purananam Panchama Veda Uchite, that these Itihasas, the histories, and the Puranas are known as the fifth Veda. So how can people say the Puranas are something new when they're mentioned in the oldest Veda? I mean, that's one point. Another point is people say, you know, the worship of Krishna or the worship of Vishnu is something new, but you actually find in historical records when like Greek ambassadors, like Megasthenes, went to India, he discovered people worshiping Krishna. And he even thought that when people, and I mentioned this before, when people said Hare Krishna, they were saying something else, you know, Hercules or something, like Heracles. He confused it. You know, he didn't know the Sanskrit that well. And then there was another Greek ambassador, and I forget his name right now, who actually, 100 years before Christ, who actually became a Hare Krishna devotee. You know, shaved his head and worshipped Prabhupada. No, he didn't worship Prabhupada. But he just became a regular Hare Krishna devotee, Greek person, a first convert, first Western convert to Krishna consciousness was 100 years before Christ. So there's so much indication, historical indication in the Vedas themselves, you know, internal indication, that the worship of Krishna and the Puranas are as ancient as the Vedas, the original four Vedas or the original one Veda, whatever you want to talk about, itself. So, and there's so much indication that that's the purpose of the Vedas. Of course, Krishna says that himself, and I've mentioned that many times before. And Prabhupada has mentioned it, and Krishna has mentioned it. Vedai Charsavaya Hamne Vavedyo. So, anyway, these are some points that we can get. So, we have about half a minute left. So, any questions or comments or arguments? Yeah. Anyabhi lashita shunyam jnana karmana avritam anukul yena krishnana shilanam bhakti uttamam. That's surrender to Krishna. Which means, that's Rupa Goswami's verse in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which means devoid of any subtle or gross desire for sense gratification, means actively serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the way that he wants with a sense of devotion. There's five different aspects to surrender. So that's how I would define surrender. Not to do what Krishna wants, but to do it resentfully, but to do it with a spiritual
wants.
Like Arjuna, he wanted to be Vedic. He wanted to serve Krishna in the way that he wanted to serve.